back. It's a crime. It's a crime.
Here come the drums.
C-R-I-M-E-W-A-V. You're rolling with the Crime Wave, the internet's first and only podcast devoted to the crime short story. I'm Seth Harwood, your host, the first name in crime podcast fiction, and I'm ready to bring you this week's story. The Crime Wave is produced by Mystery Dog, Aldo Calcagno, and it is not safe for your minivans. That means it might contain swearing, violence, and all types of shit.
Tommy, Jimmy, and me. When I first heard about Jimmy, I was a reporter for a London paper, what they laughingly called an investigative journalist, which meant I poked my nose into other people's lives and rummaged about until I came up with something that smelled nasty enough to interest our readers. Anyway, times were bad. Sales of the paper were going down. Advertising wasn't coming in like it had. So staff had to be cut. It was the usual balls up. They kept accountants and sacked reporters. Why not? We were only supposed to be a bloody newspaper, for God's sake. I'd been on the paper for about 15 years, so I was pretty safe. I kept my job, but ended up having to do the work of two reporters and moved across to life interest, which, in layman's terms, means all the stupid crap that gets into the print but isn't real news. But what could I do? Twice divorced, ex-investigative reporters with a drink problem aren't the easiest animals to place when it comes to finding a new job, and certainly not at my age. Jimmy's name first came up when I started drinking in a boozer in Kilburn. I'd had to move into a cheap, furnished flat, and Kilburn was cheap by London standards. I was in financial queer street because my lovely ex-wife, the second one, had a better lawyer than me. For Christ's sake, Dr. Bloody Crippen probably had a better lawyer than me, and Crippen was hung. The boozer was a small affair round the back of the high road. Old-timers got in there mostly. Blokes who liked to talk about the old days. And two or three times, Jimmy's name came up. He sounded interesting, so I asked about him. They clammed up. What it was, see, they didn't know me. I was new to the place. Only been there about 3 months. They were friendly enough to talk to, but asking about Jimmy firmly closed the door on me. Well, I might be doing life interest, but I was still a reporter. Slam the door in my face when I've asked an awkward question, and it's guaranteed to get me going. I'd never told anyone in the boozer I was a reporter. With most people, reporters are a lower life form than rapists, and only one step up from child molesters. So I'd said I was a writer, which turned out to be very handy, because it meant I could still ferret about for information on this Jimmy character. I kept at it, but after a couple of weeks, all I could find out was that he had been a local, tied into organised crime somehow, and wasn't someone you messed with. Not much for 2 weeks' work. Then, one evening, I was trying a different boozer when a bloke came over and sat by me. He said he'd heard I would make it worth his while if he gave me some information on Jimmy. Now I knew I could still wangle a tenner for information on expenses, so I offered him that, depending on what he had. What he had was a name, a bit of background, and a place. The name was Tommy Flavin. The background was that Tommy had grown up in Kilburn and knew Jimmy, whose second name was Costello. Both had become coppers, and both had worked in the CID. Tommy as an inspector and Jimmy as a sergeant. And both had been bent. When Tommy retired, he sold up and went to live in Italy, in a place he'd bought somewhere called Porto Santo Serafina. If I wanted to know about Jimmy Costello, he said this Tommy Flavin could tell me the whole story. Which was fine, but all I was getting so far from my tenor was a bit of a story, with holes in it. Nothing my paper would pay me to follow up, and certainly nothing they'd send me to Italy to chase down. I took 2 fives out of my wallet and put one on the table. He took it and stuffed it into his pocket. I kept the other fiver where he could see it and said I needed more if it was going to join its mate. By this time he was getting nervous, looking around, but nobody was taking any notice. He told me to ask Tommy about a bloke called Zielinski, but that didn't get me anywhere, so I held on to my fiver. By this time he was sweating. God, he must have needed the money, because he really didn't want to talk any more. Then he told me Jimmy was hooked up to Denny Morris. And that was what I was waiting for. I held out the fiver. He snatched it and disappeared out of that pub door like a rat up a drainpipe. It had been like pulling bloody teeth, and for him just as painful. But at least now I knew why they'd all clammed up when I started talking about Jimmy. I thought they wouldn't talk to me because they were protecting one of their own, but I was wrong. They'd clammed up because they were frightened. This Jimmy character had been gone quite a long time, but obviously when he frightened people, they stayed frightened, which was bad for them, but good for me. So, what my 10 quid bought was 2 bent CID coppers, a place in Italy, and 2 names, Zielinski and Denny Morris. Zielinski meant nothing, but the other name did. Every reporter had heard of Denny Morris when I was starting out. He ran North London and was an evil bastard. If this Jimmy was linked to Morris, there had to be a story. I was sure of it. I could bloody well smell it. The next day, I went to the editor and pitched it. She didn't like it, because it meant sending me to Italy. But the way I dressed it up, she bought it. But only on the condition that I brought back a piece with a sex angle. Wife swapping among the local expats, something like that. That way, if there was no Jimmy story, she still got something to keep the accountants happy. And if there was something, she got 2 stories for the price of one. Tommy Flavin may have been a bent copper, but he retired clean and wasn't hiding from anybody. His address and phone number were easy enough to get, so I gave him a bell to see what sort of reception I would get. I told him I was a writer doing research for a crime story I wanted to write, set in 90s London. I needed background, and I needed a central character. I'd heard about Jimmy, and he interested me. Maybe he was the character I was looking for. It went better than I could have expected. Yes, he knew Jimmy, and yes, he could tell me all about it. He said it was a story, all right, one that was worth a lot of money if it got told right. He agreed to talk to me, and I said I'd be happy to pay if the stuff turned out to be what I wanted. I didn't mention how much, but I think I might have given him the impression it was going to be in 4 figures. Still, we can all dream. If it was really good, I might be able to go to a ton. Certainly no more. But it would have to be good. In fact, it would have to be shit hot. We met in a bar overlooking the harbour. I'd never heard of the place, but it was like something out of a travel brochure. A small fishing harbour with a scattering of fancy yachts. The sort of place money knows about and keeps to itself. If Tommy could afford to live there, he had more under his mattress than a copper's pension. It was lunchtime, and we sat at a table outside and had a drink. I envied him. Sunshine, blue sea, a picture postcard place to live, and no money problems. That was the first thing we talked about, money. He said I could forget about paying him for the information. What he wanted was to have someone's help write a book. A book he'd wanted to write for a very long time. A book about Jimmy Costello. And to do that, he needed a proper writer. He would tell me the whole story if I helped him turn it into a book, and we go 50-50 on what it brought in. Of course, my problem was that I had told him I was a writer, not a reporter. So from the off, I was struggling. I wanted the story, but I didn't want to write any book. I said I might be interested, but he would have to give me some idea what it was all about. Yeah, he understood that. We'd have lunch in his apartment, and he'd tell me a story. If I liked the story, we'd talk about me staying on and working on the book together. I said, okay, I'd listen to what he had to say. Why not? At worst, I'd get a free lunch. And it was a good lunch. The man could cook. Local fish, a salad, and a bottle of some local wine. He was keen to get going and didn't waste any time. He started in on his story as soon as the food was on the table in front of us. Him and Jimmy had grown up in Kilburn, both become coppers in the Met, and both transferred into the CID. The story he wanted to tell me happened when he got a call from a DI who wanted to know about Jimmy. Now, Jimmy had left the force a few years before, but he was back, and nobody was happy that he was back. The very last thing anybody wanted was some smart ass of an inspector asking questions about him. Tommy said he got told to give the DI enough to keep him happy, but steered him away from the stuff that was long buried, the stuff nobody wanted dug up. He arranged to meet the DI in a pub he knew, a real rat's ass of a place. Anyway, this DI, Tommy called him Joe, agreed to meet. Detective Inspector Joe Deal did not drink, and he didn't like pubs, especially pubs like the one in which he found himself, waiting for Tommy Flavin. He asked for coffee, but that exotic drink not being available, he had settled, after some discussion with the barmaid, for bottled water, although it was a brand he had never heard of. He felt and looked out of place. The pub was in a back street, in a part of London he didn't know and didn't want to know. There was no food, it smelled of stale cigarette smoke, and it was dirty. All the tables had ashtrays, and they were all full. He assumed they paid someone to fill them before the pub opened, because it was only midday, and there were only himself and two other men in the bar. He sipped his water. The two men smoked and shared a table in silence, except for the occasional hacking cough. Each had a pint glass on the table, which they occasionally noticed, considered, and took a drink from. The barmaid stood wiping a glass with a grimy cloth. She had a cigarette in her mouth and managed to cough occasionally without losing control of her fag. She had not been employed for her looks, conversation, social skills or hygiene. Her talents, whatever they were, remained a mystery to Joe Deal. He looked at his watch. Flavin had said 12. He would wait until 12:20 and then leave. He would not have another drink. About 5 minutes later, the door opened and Tommy Flavin walked in, nodded to Deal, came to the table. Flavin sat down. He was obviously expecting Deal to supply the drinks. "What'll you have, Tommy?" "We'll have pints, Joe. No good coming here if you don't have a pint. The beer's the only good thing about this dump, but it's worth coming for. Best pint in London, some say, and I don't say they're wrong. It's a bit early for me. It's only beer, Joe. Not real alcohol. It won't slur your handwriting. Let's make it pints, eh? And he looked significantly at Deal. Deal got up and went to the bar. The barmaid ignored him as he looked at the beer handles. There were two handles and three automatic taps. He turned. Which is it, Tommy?
Stanley's. The rest are rubbish.
Deal turned back to the bar, fearing that this public condemnation of the majority of her wares might rouse the fiend in the barmaid. But she continued wiping the glass. Deal tapped on the counter with a coin. She put down the glass and cloth and came and stood before him, silent.
2 pints of Stanley's.
And then he added,
in straight glasses.
She took a glass and began to pull the pint. Deal felt better. He felt he was getting the hang of the place. He might even actually try the beer. This pub might be worth mentioning.
A dump, of course, where you need breathing apparatus and maybe a tetanus, but worth it for the Stanleys.
He must write down the name of the beer.
Some say it's the best in London, and I wouldn't disagree.
2 pints of murky liquid, each with a thin foam on top, were put in front of him. He paid and took the beer back to the table, put one in front of Tommy Flavin and sat down. He took a sip from his own pint. It surprised him. It was revolting. Worse even than it looked.
Thanks for coming, Tommy. Jimmy Costello, you know him?
Flavin nodded.
Is this part of your murder, then?
No. The killing will turn out to be purely routine. We'll probably lift somebody for it.
What I want is just for my own personal use.
Off the record? Deal nodded. He decided not to try any more beer. Even the water had tasted odd. He would just talk and listen. Flavin leaned back.
Is Costello a problem? How does he come to be in your frame?
Costello works in a refuge where the woman who got knifed worked. When I found out he'd been a detective in these parts, I thought I should get some background. That's all.
All right, Joe. You just drink your pint, and I'll tell you all about Jimmy Costello.
And he waited. Deal slowly picked up his glass, and then took a small drink. It was still revolting. Tommy still waited. Joe realized he was going to have to drink the stuff and seemed to be enjoying it if he was to get any story out of Flavin. With a weak smile on his face, he raised his glass.
Cheers.
And he consigned his soul to God and took a long drink. Tommy said,
cheers.
And then began his story.
Jimmy was Irish as it gets in Kilburn. Born there, grew up there, dad from Mayo, mother from Cork City. I was from around that part of London as well, and I remember his mum, Betty. Her accent was so thick, some stranger once asked me if she was Polish. Jimmy was never in trouble as a lad, boxed at a Catholic club. Very useful, I heard, but it never went anywhere. He was an altar boy till he left school, and then beyond. No Holy Joe, you understand. It was just something he did. When he left school, he joined his dad and worked on the buses for a few years. Then he went off to be a copper. He was a good bobby. Worked in the area, made good progress, then joined the CID. He married a local girl, Bernadette Callahan. Nice girl, very quiet, very devout. He met her through the church, I think, something like that. Anyway, Jimmy got to be Detective Sergeant. He was steady more than clever, but he could have gone up further. As it was, he stayed a sergeant and stayed local. He made quite a name for himself. He was respected. He took money, but no one ever felt they bought him. And he never took money for something he didn't want on his patch. Ordinary villains knew just where they stood with Jimmy. If it was yes, you were told the price, paid and got on with it. If it was no, it was no. Further inquiries were not encouraged. How did he get away with it? How come no one pushed past him? There must have been plenty about who wouldn't take no from a DS. Depends on the DS, and it depends on how far he'll go. Jimmy went all the way. One time, he was in a club with two other coppers. They were drinking and playing cards. Just beer and gin rummy, nothing serious. Anyway, they're sitting there, and in walks this girl. A knockout, about 16 or 17. She walks over to their table and leans on it, and lets her coat fall open. And underneath, she's stark bollock naked. She asks, "Which one's Costello?" They tell her, and she says to him, "I'm a little present for you. Want to take me somewhere and unwrap me?" Well, as I say, she was something. But Jimmy just says, "I don't take presents, just money. Tell your pimp." She looked at him, closed her coat and left. Next minute, in walks this big bloke, very expensive. He comes to the table, takes out a bundle of notes and drops them in front of Jimmy. He leans down, puts his hand on the table so his face is close to Jimmy's and says, "There's a grand, cash. I'll have my girls on the street tonight and I don't want to hear from you ever again. That's all you get." Next thing, Jimmy puts his pint glass straight through this bloke's face. What a mess. A total mess. Blood everywhere. Up gets Jimmy, grabs the bloke, slams his face down on the table, cuffs him and says, "This is what happened. He came in, drunk and wild, went for me and his head got pushed onto the beer glass on the table while we were trying to restrain him." Calm as you like. As if he had the story ready. Then he counts out 500 quid, pockets it, pushes the rest into the bloke's pocket, holds him up and says to him, "When you get out, you can have two girls on each of the streets I tell you, and I want a steady 100 a week from you." Then we take him off and bang him up. We told the story like Jimmy says, and the bloke went down for 6 months for assaulting an officer. So, Costello didn't like girls and was violent with villains. Nothing special there. That's one way of looking at it. Is there another? Yes. What is it? Jimmy Costello was mad. What? You mean a psycho? I mean mad. He was married with two kids and went to mass with his family every Sunday. Regular as clockwork. He never looked at another woman, and at home, he was the best dad a kid could have. But on the street, he'd do you in without a second thought if you worried him. How do you mean, worried him? There was a bloke called Zelensky, a Pole, I think, or Ukrainian, something like that. Anyway, he turned up, violent, dangerous, definitely on the way up and quickly. But he had a slack mouth. He was talking in a pub about how he was moving in and how he knew Jimmy didn't take gifts, just money. He said that Jimmy wasn't getting any money, but if he got in his way, he'd get a present. One of his kids' head in a box. Jimmy's kids, Michael and Eileen, were only nippers then, about 7 and 8. So, 2 nights later, they fished Zelensky out of the Thames. He had half a bottle of vodka inside him and a bang on the head commensurate with a fall. The bottle was still in his pocket. A nicely organised accident. All the best accidents are, Joe, you know that. But the point is, nobody felt like going for Jimmy's family after that. So, he's a killer. It was an accident. It wasn't even investigated. So, Costello never had a mark against him. Oh, yes. A10 looked closely at Jimmy at least 3 times, but nothing ever got proved. The first time he got pulled, I was making my first try for inspector. Some copper had said something to A10. I don't know why or who, but I heard Jimmy knew, so I went to see him. Nobody wanted a copper's body fished out the bloody river. But I needn't have worried. I remember exactly what he said. "It's all right, Tommy. I don't mind standing up to a look over by the internals. I've been careful. You don't need to be violent if you're careful." And he was right. They never had anything on him. When he went, it was with a clean record. So, he was on the take. Killed at least one person. And fronted like a good family man. You missed the point, Joe. He only took what was coming to him. He protected his wife and kids. He really was a good family man. And he really took mass and all that crap seriously. You can't have it both ways, Tommy. You can if you're mad. The Krays were like that. Denny Morris was like that. Lenny Monk was like that before he let it all slip. They were all mad. I've seen Jimmy go up against a professional, and the professional back off because something had been switched off in Jimmy. He knew that he would go down, but he let you know he'd hurt you before you could put him down. Hurt you enough to make it matter. You had to be prepared to go all the way with Jimmy, or leave it alone. Mind you, he wasn't violent normally. Usually he was a quiet bloke. I asked him once, after we'd done a nasty lift, if he was ever frightened. He said, "I'm frightened most of the time, Tommy. But my mum told me a long time ago, you will often be frightened, son, but don't let it interfere. Just do what has to be done and leave the rest in God's hands." And that's what he did, although I don't think God had ever shaken hands on the deal. And Jimmy was a good copper. A good copper, a good detective. His arrest rate was something special, but more than that, he got a result in court more often than most. If he was on the case and someone got nicked, you had a very fair chance of getting the verdict. And he didn't fiddle the evidence. He got it all by hard graft. When I went back to the Nick as an inspector, I always saw to it that the roster got me Jimmy as my sergeant for the times you needed a bloody good detective. He had a way with it. So, why did he leave? Tommy looked at Deal. He took early retirement. And after that, he was gone. No one knew where. Tommy kept on telling his story. And I knew as he talked that I would stay and write that book. I even had a title for it. Bad Catholics. So, after the meal, we fixed things up. What was there for me to go back to in London? A crummy job, a crummy flat, and a crummy life. I stayed on and started writing the story Tommy told me. I never gave a second thought to the paper. They'd soon get tired of waiting and get somebody else. There was only one thing that worried me. It was clear from what Tommy told me that this Jimmy Costello was a toxic bastard. I didn't want him coming after me when the book got published. He sounded like a man who wouldn't take kindly to having the world know what sort of copper he'd been. I mentioned it to Tommy after a couple of weeks. He told me not to worry. Jimmy was dead. Finally upset the wrong man. Stopped a knife. Somewhere in Spain. That's why he'd never tried to write the book before. He didn't want Jimmy looking for him either. Well, the book got finished after about a year, but what I didn't tell Tommy was that I'd already sent the first four chapters to a publisher who said they'd take it on when it was finished and offered me a very nice advance. Tommy never saw it coming. One day I was gone, and that was that. I didn't use my own name when the book was published, and I'd never told him the title I was going to use, so Tommy probably never even knew it existed. After that, it should have been plain sailing. Bad Catholics did well. I got a contract for another Jimmy Costello book, and I wish I could say we all lived happily ever after. But we didn't. About a year after Bad Catholics had come out, I saw a bit in a paper. A UK citizen, an ex-CID inspector who had served with the Met,
had died after an accident in Porto Santa Serafina. His body had been fished out of the harbour. Apparently he had been drinking. He had half a bottle of vodka in his stomach and a wound to the head which looked like he had fallen. The bottle was still in his jacket pocket. The police didn't suspect foul play. They weren't looking for anybody. Recognise it? Same as bloody Zelinsky. I knew right away Jimmy wasn't dead, that he'd found the book and done for Tommy. And before he did, he'd have got my real name out of him. So there we are. Jimmy's looking and I'm running, and writing while I run. Who knows? Maybe I'll make it. Maybe someone will get Jimmy before he gets me. But I'm not putting any money on it. Jimmy's a professional, and I'm at best a gifted amateur. The second book about Jimmy, Stealing God, is finished, and I'm well into the third, Yesterday's Sins. Look out for them. But if number three never turns up, you'll know Jimmy got to me before anybody got to him. Which will be a pity, because it's going to be a bloody cracker. Even Jimmy will be proud of it.
In fact, it's a crime. It's a crime.
Here come the drums!
Thank you for listening to The Crime Wave. I'm your host, Seth Harwood. I hope you'll check out the rest of the stories here on Crime Wave and tell your friends about it. It's the CRIMEWAV. Help pass the word, register at our site so that you can participate in the forums and add comments to the episodes. You can email us with questions or comments at info@crimewave.com. Aldo, the mystery dog, and I will get your email and we'll get back to you right quick. You can also call the K7 line, 206-350-4998, to leave comments or feedback. And if you leave a great message, we'll even play it at the end of a show. So drop a line, hop on the website, visit often, spread the word, and thank you for stopping by The Crime Wave. Get trusted.